studio at Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number you'll call, 1-800-462-7413. And, of course, along with your call, some topics to talk over.
Yes, pop music. Is that encouraging our teenagers to drink more? And how about product placement on television, such as cigarettes? Is that encouraging our teenagers to smoke more?
Okay, coming up, and?
The polar vortex and how it's going to affect those with allergies. Stay tuned and don't sneeze on this topic.
Allergy season coming up.
That's right.
800-462-7413. Oh, and our recipes.
Yes, pork chop suey. Now, you might think the chop suey, which is an Americanism of Chinese food, and pork chop suey is an old recipe, and the answer is you're right. It is an old recipe, but this happened to be a recipe that is tried and true, and I loved making chop suey when I was a kid in college because I could feed 20 people on a slim budget.
This is my kind of recipe, I've got to say. Again, 800-462-7413 to the phones now, Zorba. We welcome a listener in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
I want to know, what is your opinion of having a relative as your primary care physician?
Oh, you mean, well, who's the relative?
A brother-in-law.
Well, the first question is, what sort of a relationship do you have with your brother-in-law?
Obviously, we live in the same area. It's a pretty close relationship.
Okay, pretty close relationship. Have you seen him for things before?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Good, good, good. You know, I don't find anything wrong with that at all, but I'll tell you some very interesting things. Now, we've got to parse a few things here. First of all, we have to parse controlled substances, okay? Adderall, drugs that are used for ADD that you can buy on the street anywhere in America. I don't know how much they are a pill, but a decent price. Hydrocodone and oxycodone, those are controlled substances. On the whole, and when I say on the whole, except in very rare circumstances, if anyone is going to give you a pill that is a narcotic or a controlled substance, you really want that to be a non-relative. There are ethical issues here, there are some moral issues here, and there's state issues that vary by different states. So, for instance, if my wife Penny broke her leg and I was away in California and all of a sudden she ran out of her pain pills and I couldn't get one of my partners to call in a prescription, I might go to the pharmacy and explain what it is, and they might give me a few pills. But that would be last chance. In other words, I would get on the phone, call one of my partners, because I might be then accused of using these drugs. That's kind of the issue, one issue. The other issue really is objectivity. You know, can somebody who's close to you be objective? Some docs say, no, they really can't be objective. Some say, really, I can be objective. And one of the best terms I heard for this within the last year when I was at Mayo Clinic doing some research work was VIP-itis. In other words, if the person is a VIP, a very important person, sometimes we treat them differently and we don't give them the best medical care because we're not objective. And so
that could happen if it's a relative.
A relative is a VIP. Who's the VIP in your lifetime? It's Monica.
Yeah.
She is the VIP.
Yeah.
Penny is the VIP in my life and my kids. So I might not be objective. Now, I have some in-laws. Would I consider myself to be as close to them? No, I wouldn't consider that. So it really wouldn't affect me. So that's kind of where I would look at it. You're comfortable going to him?
In most circumstances, yes.
Most. What are the ones you're not?
Well, and anything to do with gynecology, anything like that.
Exactly.
I shy away from that.
Right, and that's the other things of a more personal nature. Yeah. But no, you know, with the new federal guidelines now, if you are over the age of 30 and you're HPV, human papillomavirus negative, and you've had a pap test that had been normal, I can't remember the number, it's either 2 or 3, you then go on a 5-year cycle. So you only need a pap test every 5 years. I mean, it's become a much, much more rare event that you need a pap test. And I have patients who actually come to see me, and then they go to one of our physician assistants. We have a PA and a nurse practitioner in our office, and they feel more comfortable having a woman do the pap smear. So they see me for everything else, and they do it. So I think you're square. I think you're fine. You'd be okay going good. With your brother-in-law.
Well, thank you very much for the help.
A pleasure. Thanks
Appreciate
for listening.
The call. What about a close friend as a physician?
Well, I have seen my close friends. I think close friends are all right. I think, you know, once again, it's a moral sort of ethical issue. I don't have a problem with
that. So you think
them.
It could work?
Where it could work, you mean where you
well,
could...
Well, say people get together once a week for a radio show, if one were the...
Oh, never. I don't think there's any way that you could ever be objective. I would give a close friend like that for a radio show, you know, just drugs that would harm them. That's exactly it.
So now or I understand.
Now you know why you're on 10 pills that cause you problems.
1-800-462-7413, toll free, 800-462-7413. So, Zorba, some info on pop music and alcohol and pop culture, TV shows, and cigarettes.
Right. So before we do the pop music and alcohol, I want to tell you about an interesting article that came out of the British Medical Journal recently looking at tobacco products and TV and placement. Mm-hmm. Now, we know, you know, used to be that Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Right.
I still have these jingles in my,
in
my mind. And LSMFT, Lucky Strike means fine
tobacco. Right.
You know, and those are the ones I remember. And then the jingles went away. Huge issue. Tobacco industry supported television early on. Well, this particular study, they looked at primetime television. They coded roughly 2,000 hours of primetime television from 1955 to the year 2010. Mm-hmm. And what they did is they coded it for the number of people who smoke cigarettes in, not in a commercial, but in the actual shows hour. Then they looked at the number of instances of smoking per hour. And back in the early 50s, there were generally 5 smokes per hour. So people smoked 5 times a day they picked up the cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Back now in the year 2010, it dropped to 0.29. In other words, there was 1 cigarette smoker every 5 hours instead of 5 smokers per hour.
Right.
Then they look back, the price of cigarettes, the influence that television may have. And these particular researchers have now determined, this is a real question, that when you reduce the amount of smoking you see on TV, you are not encouraging people to smoke. In other words, they don't see it. And whether or not smoking should be banned from all television, that's the question they wanted to answer.
Well, I've got to tell you, I have problems with this. For one thing, cause and effect, I can't imagine that there's real science that shows
There's no cause and effect. It's a cultural thing. But when you don't see people smoking as much,
is as people have stopped smoking, the popular culture has maybe eased off.
Both ways. You don't see it as much. You don't do it as much. We used to have an ashtray in our house if people smoked
in the cabin. You used to have them in your waiting room, too.
Yes, we had ashtrays in our waiting room back in the early 80s. Yeah. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, come to the Oregon Clinic and you can smoke.
I used to watch a show. This is really early television. It was, I forget the guy's name. It was one of these cop shows or detective shows, half an hour long, that they would go through the, you know, the script thing, and part of the script was he would stop in at a tobacco store and order whatever Dunhill or whatever the tobacco was, and they'd have a little conversation about
it. And he'd be smoking.
It was part of the plot of the thing.
See, so that was part of the culture.
Yeah.
That culture has changed because our culture has changed. Television and that is part of the culture.
Then they made a rule in television that you couldn't do that you had to separate the commercial from the plot.
Right.
Then it's sort of come full circle that now you have product placement, which is essentially the same thing.
Well, and smoking is subliminal product placement that may affect young children. Yeah. So the question is, in this study, is whether or not pop music, talking about alcohol and drugs then, is that product placement encouraging our teens to drink?
And what does this say?
Well, maybe. That's what it says. It says maybe.
Look
at it.
Write it down.
I mean, maybe. Well, it says in this particular study, this was, you know, alcoholism, clinical and experimental research. So it's one of these little journals, and they pulled, you know, kids around the country, and they said, well, you listen to this band and this band.
Yeah.
And the ones that listened to bands that drank more on the whole, not everyone.
Yeah.
And the ones that listened, you know, where it was mentioned by the band.
Yeah.
But this is a question about pop culture and how much it actually affects us.
You know, you can't have a movie or television show that's based in a certain period with the kind of characters that would smoke. You can't have them not smoke.
Well, yeah. How about Mad Men without tobacco?
Well, exactly.
That's what I mean. You couldn't have it. On the other hand, when you look at all the tobacco there, and I watch it occasionally, I look at it and I remember what it was like on my when I was a kid. Everybody in my family smoked.
Yeah.
So one more thing with product placement. Yeah. When I was reading about this and doing the research, 64% of all the men smoked before the Surgeon General's report came out.
Yeah.
Before World War II, it was only 32%. Guess who encouraged people to smoke cigarettes? The United States government.
Oh,
because they
really?
Put 10 cigarettes in each container
of
K-rations so that our boys could smoke. And what happened was smoking was more expensive prior to World War II, and it was an affectation of the upper class. After World War II, it became ubiquitous, and that's why the guys smoke. Our government encouraged smoking back in World War II. Go Uncle Sam.
1-800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And we go back to the phones now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
I wanted to ask Dr. Zorba about diabetes and about chia seeds. I've heard that chia seeds are good for helping you lose weight and cleaning out your intestine and your colon and all that. And what are those five foods that a person should eat every day, especially when he's diabetic, and at what times should he eat them?
Uh-huh. Now, do you have diabetes?
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Are you on pills or diet or insulin? Tell me a little bit about it.
Pills and diet. I take a pill in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And I eat my oatmeal, and mm-hmm. I eat a half a banana, and mm-hmm. I drink a little cup of milk.
Uh-huh.
And 2 hours later,
uh-huh.
I'll eat 2 or 3 graham crackers and another little bitty cup of milk.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll eat whatever I want for lunch.
Mm-hmm. So what's your lunch? When you say you eat what you want to, is it 1,000 calories, 2,000 calories? How many calories you think
it is? Well, for lunch, I might have steak, which mm-hmm. I don't try to get a very big one. I might have mashed potatoes, and mm-hmm. I might have some leafy greens, or spinach, or broccoli, or something like that.
Uh-huh. Well, I've a couple of suggestions. First of all, chia seeds are good. Any seed, any nut, tree nuts and seeds are good, especially if they're not salted. There's nothing wrong with salt, but we get too much salt in our diet. So on the whole, I tell people buy seeds that are not salted because they're delicious, and then you get used to eating them without salt, and that taste changes. I don't think there's any evidence that chia seeds are better than other seeds, sunflower seeds or safflower seeds. But I think they're a good seed. I think one of the issues with diabetics is the fact that you want to have food throughout the day, and you want the food to be high fiber with a low glycemic index. Now, a glycemic index is how fast blood sugar rises after you eat something. So the perfect thing that has a high glycemic index is sugar. You know, if you have sugar syrup, Karo syrup, maple syrup, that has the highest glycemic index. Have a teaspoon, all of a sudden your blood sugar goes up. Things that have low glycemic index are things that we tend to digest slowly, nuts and seeds. High fiber. If you're looking for whole wheat cereal or whole grain or cereal or whole grain bread, you want to look at it. It may say whole wheat, but you want to look at the fiber content. You want the fiber to be higher. And the new federal regulations on labels that will be here, I'm not sure when, but sometime soon, is going to really list fiber in there. But an increase in fiber is what counts. So I don't think there are five special foods that you have to eat, but I think you want to look at the massive food that you're eating and the glycemic index. What do you do for a living?
I'm a truck driver.
Truck driver. So you're on the road all the time. You pack your lunch? You're over the road?
Yes, sir. I try and go to Walmart and get me 100% whole grain bread. I try and keep some fruit in, which mm-hmm. I take maybe half a banana instead of a whole banana.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep oatmeal mm-hmm. and I keep graham crackers with me at all times.
Yeah, those are really important things, and especially when you don't want your blood sugar to become too low. Obviously, that's a big issue. You want to make sure you get enough sleep. But one of the issues that truck drivers always have is exercise. You know, how do you exercise? Where do you get your exercise? Well, exercise is cumulative throughout the day. 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, 15 minutes here, 15 minutes there. It makes a difference. So one of the things I would recommend you do when you stop your rig, when you have lunch, is you make sure you get an extra 10 minutes to just walk around. And, you know, you do one or two walks around the parking lot. It can make a big difference. Those parking lots are big. And buy yourself a pedometer, because a pedometer is going to tell you how much you're actually walking. The goal is 10,000 steps a day. Very hard to get that in your line of work, but it'll show you how many steps you get when you walk around over lunchtime. See how many steps that you can get and give yourself a good 10 minutes of walking, and that's going to make a big difference in your diabetes, especially if you do it after you eat.
Well, thank you, Dr. Zorba. And I'm a little bit more fortunate than a lot of truck drivers. I drive a flatbed, so I'm out tarping and I'm out strapping it down and chaining it down. And I get a little bit during that time.
Well, you do. You actually get a significant amount during that time. You know, as you said, if you're just sitting in the rig, it's one thing. You're strapping it down and doing things. You're getting much more work. And you are. That will make you fortunate. Every time you use your muscles, you improve your diabetes, because there are two factors that influence diabetes. Calories in, that's the number one factor, and how much we use our muscles. And they're independent factors. So every time you strap down something in that truck, you are improving your diabetes. Keep it up.
All right. Well, I really appreciate the information. I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. Thank you.
Eats pretty well for a truck driver.
Yeah, he does.
And when he told us about his lunch, I was thinking, this guy's a trucker. Steak, mashed potatoes, veggies. That's not something you cook up at noon.
It's not what you eat when you stop and go into the diner. That's exactly it.
1-800-462-7413. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a question from a listener, Vern. Zorba and Tom, I have a cooking and health question. Because of our age, we want to replace our old and heavy cast iron utensils. A friend said to stay away from aluminum cookware because of the possible connection with Alzheimer's. What does the science say, and what do you guys use for cooking? What I use for cooking, by the way, is a credit card.
It's a credit card.
And I'm a pretty good tipper, too.
Tom,
how about you?
It's a credit card. Well, first of all, I love cast iron. And that's the main cookware that I use in my house. And I love it. And even though I'm getting older, hey, I got to lift the cast iron. I'll keep my muscles up. They're pretty heavy.
Some people may not be able
to. Right, exactly. Yeah. I think aluminum cookware is fine. I don't think there's any evidence that aluminum cookware is connected with Alzheimer's. The feds have looked at this in tremendous detail, because as we know, as we get older, Alzheimer's is in there, and there's no evidence that consuming aluminum, and we do that, by the way, if you have Maalox, which is aluminum hydroxide, we actually give that to people when they have an upset stomach. It used to be the drug of choice. Now it's not used very much at all. But I don't think there's anything wrong with aluminum cookware at all. So choose your cookware well. A better cookware is one with a surface that doesn't chip. Now, there's some people who say Teflon is bad. Teflon plastic causes this problem and that problem. If that's your belief, stay away from Teflon. But again, Teflon has been around since the 50s and has not been shown to connect to anything. So I would just choose a cookware you like and you like to cook with.
Do you have a question for the good doc? Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up, more of your calls, of course, our medical myth buster, some more really good research to talk over, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. More phone calls coming up after our recipe, Zorba, this one for pork chop suey.
Pork chop suey. Okay, so chop suey. You know, an Americanism, sort of a, you know, a Chinese version of an American stew. So, okay, we're going to make this recipe, talk a little bit about why this is better. And anyone who remembers what chop suey used to be like as a kid, make this recipe. I think you'll like it.
Okay.
Okay. 1 cup of reduced sodium chicken broth.
A cup of reduced sodium chicken broth.
That's right. And the reason is there's lots of salt and sort of everything else. Mm-hmm. 3 tablespoonfuls of reduced sodium soy sauce.
3 big T reduced sodium soy sauce.
2 tablespoonfuls of molasses.
2 big T molasses.
Okay. Now, there are different kinds of molasses. When you start with sugar cane, which is where most of it comes from, the first thing that comes off the sugar cane is called cane syrup. That's the first press. Mm-hmm. And when I was in Southeast Asia, whenever I go to India, you can buy cane syrup right off the street. They take sugar cane, they actually squeeze it through, the cane syrup comes up, and it's quite good. Mm-hmm. The second pressing is molasses. So you want to buy molasses. The third pressing, where there's hardly any sugar, is blackstrap molasses. Mm. Now, blackstrap molasses has hardly any sweetness to it. It has much more, it's much more bitter, but it is chock full of B vitamins, and it's often used as an additive to lots of health foods. Mm. In this case, you want the sweetness, so it should be plain molasses, 1/4 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper.
1/4 little T, freshly ground black pepper.
5 teaspoons of cornstarch.
5 little T cornstarch.
2 tablespoonfuls of canola oil.
2 big T canola oil.
1 pound of pork tenderloin. Trim it, cut it, and put it in little chunks, the chunks you're going to eat in this chop suey.
1 pound of pork tenderloin.
1 medium bell pepper sliced.
1 medium red bell pepper sliced.
1 medium onion sliced.
1 medium onion sliced.
5-ounce can of sliced water chestnuts.
5-ounce can of sliced water chestnuts.
5-ounce can, which is their standard can, of sliced bamboo shoots. 3 cups of bean sprouts. In this recipe, I call for mung bean sprouts, but frankly, any bean sprout is going to do, but it's got to have bean sprouts for sure.
3 cups bean sprouts.
And 1 tablespoonful of freshly minced ginger. That's ginger you take and you grate it. And you need a good tablespoonful. You could use 2 if you want to.
Okay.
Okay. Here's how we make it. Mm-hmm. Combine the broth, the soy sauce, molasses, and pepper in a medium bowl and mix it all up. Transfer 2 tablespoonfuls of the mixture to a small bowl. Stir in the cornstarch and put that off to the side. The cornstarch has to have a little liquid in it. Mm-hmm. Heat 1 tablespoonful of the canola oil in a large nonstick skillet over medium heat. Add the pork and cook until most of the pink is gone. That's going to be a couple of minutes, 2 to 3 minutes, maybe up to 5. Transfer it to a plate. Increase the heat to medium high. Add 1 tablespoonful of oil. Saute the onion, bell pepper, sprouts, water chestnuts, bamboo shoots, and ginger. Cook for about 3 minutes. Then pour that into the broth mixture and bring it to a boil. Cook, stirring for about 3 minutes. Reduce the heat to medium. Add the reserved cornstarch and the pork so that it thickens up and any juice that's in there. Cook until it's slightly thickened. That'll take about 1 minute and serve immediately with some nice cooked rice.
Yeah. Now, this is what? Not exactly heart healthy, but not bad.
Well, first of all, let's look at it. What have we done to make this better? That's really the question.
We have good pork. I mean,
we have good pork. That's exactly
not so bad pork.
Right. We're not using pork shoulder. We're not using pork steak. Yeah. We have reduced sodium soy sauce and reduced sodium broth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's not zero. And those are basically the things that make it better. Per serving, if you look at this, it's 400 calories for a serving, not that much. It's got a number of calories from fat. But the reality is this is a better way to eat a delicious old-fashioned dish. And you can do that with pretty much any recipe. You can make them better. If you added more vegetables to it, it would be even better, but it wouldn't be old-fashioned pork chop suey. Not the stuff I was brought up
with. Some newfangled version.
newfangled Pacific Rim merged chop suey. It wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't be old-fashioned.
I can find this on the web, I'll bet.
I bet you can. If you go to zorbapastor.org, you can find this recipe. You can find other recipes. You can find unbelievable pictures of Tom and with me dancing and cavorting at zorbapastor.org. Don't forget, folks, we are on Facebook and I tweet.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number to the phones again now, Zorba, a listener with us in Peoria, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, how can we help?
For the past year and a half, I've been having a weird reaction to the weather because every time it rains, I get very sick. My head feels like a pressure cooker, and I have a lot of colors in my vision, and my heart rate goes crazy, and I can't breathe sometimes. And my neck gets really stiff. And then during and after, like, the onset of rain, I still have, like, visual aberrations and stuff like that, but I also have muscle spasms, and my hands and feet get really tingly and fall asleep very easily, and I'm just really tired and have no focus. And this has been going on for, like, over a year, so I was just wondering, what the heck could this be? Yeah.
Does it happen every time it rains?
Every time.
Well, the biggest thing is there's a change in barometric pressure when it snows or it rains. You know, that's what they have, you know, barometers around. Barometers used to, I think every house when I was a kid had a barometer in it, and they'd say, is it going to rain tomorrow? And they'd go to the barometer. The barometer would predict it better than the weatherman on television, I think. So there's a change in the barometric pressure, which may be triggering all of this. What do you do for this when it actually happens? What do you do?
Sometimes I take ibuprofen for the headache, and
okay.
That seems to take the edge off, but I still feel so much pressure in my head, and the visual aberrations, like, they never really seem to go away.
What do you do? So, what do you do for a living?
I'm actually a student.
Okay. History of seizures at all?
No seizures.
Migraine headaches?
I've never really, like, definitely had any, but I'm not sure if this is what... like this actually is.
Well, that's kind of what it sounds like. Tell me about your mom. Does your mom have headaches or your dad?
No. I mean, they do, but not serious migraines.
Not serious migraine headaches. Have you ever, you've never had a seizure, lost control, you know, of your body, crashed a car in a strange way, had blackouts at all?
No.
How much alcohol do you drink?
None.
Okay. So it's not a post. Any meds that you're on? Any medications? Significant medications? Okay. Well, first of all, it sounds to me like this may be a migraine headache variant that is brought on by a change in barometric pressure.
Could this happen all of a sudden? Because she's only had this for a year.
You can get migraine headaches at any time in your life. So you can be older. You often get it when you're younger, but you can be older and get migraine variants. You can be younger and get migraine variants. And, you know, and if it's bothersome, what I think the first thing I would do is I like to start with the easiest, quickest thing. And I would get Excedrin Migraine, which is a combination of aspirin and Tylenol, aspirin and acetaminophen. And, you know, if you know the weather is going to change, I would take it. You know, and I would take probably one or two tablets every 4 to 6 hours and see prior to the event if it's happening. You know, and I would look at it, and if it seems like the weather's going to change or there's going to be a thunderstorm, I would plop two of them and see what that does. That's the first thing I would do. And then if that doesn't seem to do anything, what I think you ought to do is see your family doc or consider going to a neurologist and being tested. But it sounds to me like this is a migraine headache. I don't think it's an allergy. I don't think you're going crazy. There's something that's occurring in the barometric pressure. Well, you must have questioned that, right? Are you going nuts?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's it. I would question the same thing. But I think migraine may be the issue. And there are other medications that we give, medications such as Imitrex, that we actually give for migraine headaches. But I think I would try the over-the-counter medication first and see what that might do.
Okay.
Let us know. Let us know what happens. You're welcome.
I love the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
800-462-7413, toll free, 1-800-462-7413. Our next caller, Zorba, is a listener in Noble, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love listening to you guys' show. My problem has to do with my choice of breakfast cereals and low blood sugar. From time to time, I have an issue with low blood sugar. I guess it's a typical issue, you know, of possibly not eating and then exercising strenuously. And I almost always eat Raisin Bran for breakfast. But I started recently eating a cashew cereal for breakfast. And I try to eat healthy food for breakfast. But this other cereal I've been eating it causes my blood sugar to crash after a couple of hours. And I don't understand why that would be happening.
It causes your blood sugar. You've checked your blood sugar?
I don't check it. I'm not a diabetic. But every so often, you know, I will get if my blood sugar drops, I will get the typical clamminess, uneasiness,
nervousness. But I would check it. Go to CVS, go to Walgreens, Walmart, Target, Kmart. You don't need any money. You need money. I'm sorry. You don't need a prescription. You definitely need money when you go to the store, or at least like Tom does. His favorite pen is a credit card.
Yep.
But go there. You can buy a machine, $25. You can buy the strips. They're expensive. They're like a buck a piece. But spend a little bit of money, and then when you feel like you're crashing, check your blood sugar. See whether or not your blood sugar is really low. It may not be low. You may not feel good because something else is going on. But if you don't check your blood sugar, you don't know if it's really low. You're having some kind of a symptom afterwards. Now, if you have a fiber-filled cereal on the whole, it's going to be a low glycemic index. Sugar won't go up as high. It'll go up slower. Fiber means there's a slower digestive of sugar and cereals within our body. You know, we digest it slower, and so it doesn't go up so quickly. But I would initially check and see whether or not it's the blood sugar. If it's not the blood sugar, I'd stay away from that cereal. For some reason, you're having a side effect. Who knows what it is? Could be an additive in the cereal. Could be something they're putting in the cereal. The cereals that we eat are industrialized products. Okay, if you have oatmeal and you have, we'll say, steel-cut oatmeal or stone-ground oatmeal, you're just getting oatmeal. But when you have Kashi or Raisin Bran or other things, they put all sorts of things in it. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the label and it has more than five ingredients, Michael Pollan says more than five ingredients, it's industrialized. And I don't think five is the magic number, but you look in that cereal, there's lots of stuff in there. And you may be having a reaction to that, something. Could be a flavoring. They don't put everything that's manufactured in the cereal on the label. It can say flavorings, and it could be something in the flavoring that's doing it for you.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for your call.
We appreciate the call. And before the break, Zorba, let's take an email question from a loyal listener in Minnesota. She writes, "Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom. I'm a 55-year-old woman in the midst of menopause. My facial hair, which used to be a couple of light strands on my neck that I wouldn't see till they were about an inch long and cast a shadow, is now sprouting throughout the regular manly beard zone. I'm shaving nearly every day. Will the growth ever end, or will I be shaving 40 years from now?"
Well, the growth may not end, but there are things that she can do. How old is she?
55.
55. Yeah. So, one of the things that happens is women produce less estrogen. She's not taking estrogen. And yet women also produce testosterone. We produce it through our adrenal glands. So she doesn't have estrogen that is, if you will, suppressing some of the reaction that may be the minimal testosterone she's producing. Mm-hmm. There's a diuretic called spironolactone, spironolactone, spironolactone. And for some women, it really works well. They take this small dose of diuretic once or twice a day, and they get rid of that extra hair, hirsutism, or hair that's produced. And then there's some other things that can be done short of giving estrogen that may make a difference. So what I would recommend, she see her family doc, she try the spironolactone and see whether or not that'll work. And also there's electrolysis if that fails.
Yeah. I'd say, for one thing, good for her, 55 years old, and she's wondering what's going to be happening 40 years.
There you go. There you go. Good
way
for her.
Think Zorba can help you get out of a hairy situation? Send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, you know we have some interesting research to talk over. You have that all planned. We have our medical myth buster coming up a little later. Some more of your calls, too. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, we haven't heard enough about the polar vortex Now we have to worry about that causing allergies?
That's right. The polar vortex may mean an absolutely awful allergy season this year. It makes me so excited because I have allergies. And the reason is when spring, as spring hits, not when, but as spring hits, you have all these trees that have gone into really a deep, if you will, isolation from the cold weather. And they're all going to pop out more at the same time. It used to be sort of, you know, you would have certain trees that would pop out gradually in March. Often it's the cedars and elm and pine trees that start to bloom, and then they're followed by the maple trees, ashes, birches, and oaks. And then afterwards, you have walnut trees and then grasses in the south. And what's going to happen is because it's been so cold and it's going to turn suddenly and it's going to be so warm, we are going to have more allergies than we have ever had.
Oh, that's really great news.
It's just wonderful.
Allergies. All right, now we can talk about how to prepare for that. We can start. Yes.
I've got an easy preparation. Yeah. Go to Alaska. That's all. Stay in Alaska and stay in cold weather and you'll be fine. But short of that. But let's look overall at allergy medications, which really have improved over the years. So first of all, the allergy medications that work the best are steroid nasal sprays, prescription only. They are the best thing. Mm-hmm. I've used them for years now. Used properly in the minimal dose that works for you really reduces the swelling and discomfort in the nose and the sinuses. That's number one. Over-the-counter antihistamines, Claritin, Allegra, and Zyrtec all come in a generic form, far better than they used to be years ago, than the antihistamines were years ago. Mm-hmm. Years ago, my mother would give me Benadryl. Benadryl we used to make people sleep, you know. That was just terrible.
I guess if you're asleep, the allergies don't bother you.
Your allergies don't bother you, and if you're a child, you don't complain because you're asleep. I think that's why my mother gave it to me. And then there are eye drops. Over-the-counter eye drops, there's one called Nafcon, N-A-F-C-O-N, and Vasocon. They're in generics, too. They work really, really well. And if not, we have prescription eye drops. And frankly, you can manage these things with all three of these together or one separately.
Shouldn't we maybe start doing some of these things before the allergies actually hit?
You can start all these just before they start. But actually, if we look at injection therapy, which we used to do all the time, where we give allergy shots, they are not nearly as effective as the new medications. Not nearly. Now, for the people who have severe allergies, for the people who have asthma, for the people who the medications do not work, that's probably 2 to 3% of the population. The shots are good. Some of the newer shots are good. The over-the-counter or the under-the-top medications they use in Europe may be good, but on the whole, just use your medication to keep your allergies under control.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And back to the phones now, Zorba. We'll welcome a listener in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba. Hi, Tom.
How can we help?
Well, the reason why I am calling is basically, I want to say about 2 years ago, shortly after I had my son, I started to notice kind of a discomfort under my left rib. It wasn't anything painful, but it just felt more crowded, almost like I wanted to like pop something under there. And so finally, 2 years later, I did go to see the doctor, and he kind of checked around. Everything seemed to be okay. And he mentioned something about my splenic flexure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he was insistent that maybe a diet change would have caused it. I haven't changed my diet. But then I came home, I kind of looked it up on the internet, and, you know, I guess I'm just not really sure what to do about it. A lot of the things that I read, the people who experience it, it's like a painful kind of, I think, gassiness that kind of fills up under your rib. But it's just more irritating for me.
Well, first of all, your spleen is on the left-hand side of your body, and the splenic flexure is the part of the spleen that we can sometimes feel, especially in people who are thin. When they take a deep breath, you can often feel the tip of the spleen. You can live without. Sometimes we'll remove the spleen if it's bleeding. That's about the only time. It turns out it's a reservoir of blood, and then it's important in the immune system. So it's around there. Okay. So just because your doctor felt the spleen doesn't mean that's causing the problems at all. And, in fact, very unlikely that feeling the spleen has anything to do with your problems. Yeah, it sounds like your problems are more of acid or gas. Your symptoms are exactly when does it bother you, and what's your most uncomfortable symptom that you have?
You know, I, it's hard to pinpoint a time. Mm-hmm. I think when I notice it most is like if I'm sitting in the car or sitting on the couch. But I haven't been able to kind of pinpoint, like, is there something I'm eating or drinking that's kind of increasing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well, one of the things you want to do, I've got a couple of recommendations, is you want to keep a food diary and see if there's things that make it worse and things that make it better. On the whole, about half the people in the world can digest milk as adults and the other half cannot. So the first thing that we look at is whether or not it's a lactose intolerance. Those are very common. Lactaid, L-A-C-T-A-I-D, is a pill you can take before you have dairy products, or you can buy lactaid-reduced milk that actually reduces the milk sugar and makes it easier to digest. That's one of the things I would look at to see whether or not that, you know, whether or not milk is doing it. I would remove all dairy from your diet for a couple of weeks. If that doesn't work, then I would do is I would look at gluten, see whether or not gluten is an issue. There are a number of people who don't have celiac disease, which is a true gluten intolerance, where you actually see a change in the small intestine, but have a relative gluten intolerance. And there's a lot of hype about gluten. It's sort of the disease du jour that everyone talks about. On the other hand, there's some people that really have honest-to-goodness wheat intolerance. And I would look at wheat as sort of the next thing to remove from the diet and see if that makes a difference. But I don't think the spleen has much to do with it. The other question is if it's acid, if taking Zantac, over-the-counter Zantac, 150 milligrams twice daily for a week or two will reduce acid in the stomach. And if that's doing it, then you know it's an acid issue. And some people take Zantac every night or take Zantac once or twice a day when they know they're going to be bothered. So those are things you can look at where you can really make a step that'll make a difference.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you
so much for your help.
Oh, thanks for your call.
We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Well, Zorba, it's time once again for our medical MythBuster. On a recent show, we read an email from a listener in Huntsville, Alabama, who wrote the following. I just read an article on your treatment of tuberculosis in Tibet with the use of Young's Living Essential Oils. Could you tell me what combinations you used? Well, now Zorba wasn't exactly sure what article the emailer was referring to, so we checked the Young's Living Essential Oils website and found they are using Zorba's name to advertise their essential oils. Zorba, what's your take on this?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely junk. Well, first of all, essential oils are not essential. Let's talk about that. It's a name branding of aromatic volatile oils. So oil of clove would be an essential oil. Oil of clove is nothing essential in the body. If we look at eucalyptus oil, it's an aromatic oil. Eucalyptus oil is an essential oil. Well, is there anything? I mean, essential implies you need it, and the fact is this is hype stuff that you don't need. And they're old-fashioned treatments that are all the time. My mother put Vicks Vapor Rub on my chest, made me feel better. Did it actually cure my cold? No. Does it work for pneumonia? No. And does it work for tuberculosis? Not at all. So I went and I looked at this website, and it tells about my work on tuberculosis in Tibet. And then they said they're giving, quote, essential oils to help tuberculosis, you know, survivors in Tibet. And I thought, well, that's great. You're giving stuff that smells nice, and that's supposed to work for tuberculosis. It doesn't work at all.
And they're using your name.
And they're using my name. So TB is an infectious disease that needs antibiotics. Specifically for TB, it is the number one or number two killer in the world when you look at it, depending on which statistics you use. And essential, quote, oils, aromatic therapy doesn't do anything. It may make you feel better. It may help you with the side effects of the antibiotics you're taking or the disease. But this implies it actually helps cure tuberculosis. And it is a myth. It is bunk. And this is not any different from some of the issues that my good friend Dr. Mohammed Oz has, where people will then, he'll talk about something on the show, and then they'll use that script in advertising for their product, and he's had to do several cease and desist orders. And he's, of course, much more famous than I am, but he doesn't have the same great audience that I do. They're different people that watch the Dr. Oz show than listen to public radio. Yeah. But it is a myth. Essential oils do zero for tuberculosis. They have to cease and desist.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to debunk? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413, and our next caller is a listener in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hi, Zorba. This is Darsh. I'm from Buffalo, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm calling to talk to you about better alternatives to sugar. I'm a tea drinker, and I love chai, and I love to add tons of sugar to it. My wife always complains about that, and lately I'm trying to stay away from processed sugar and try alternatives, including using honey, store-bought honey, or brown sugar, maybe spirulina. But I just wanted to find out if you have better options for me.
Well, first of all, stevia, which is sort of the new kid on the block, which is really good. It's derived from a plant, so it's not the same as NutraSweet. It's not the it's not the same as Splenda, which are manufactured products. This is really a derived product, and certainly it's something that you can use. You're right about honey. Honey is a natural product; it certainly can be used. These all have high glycemic indexes, but honey is different in that it's actually a carbohydrate and has calories to it. Stevia has hardly any calories at all to it. So if you're looking at it from a blood sugar point of view, stevia is going to be better, natural product, better, easier to use. If you're looking from a natural product and you don't care about the calories, teaspoon of honey is only about 15 calories. Tablespoonful is 45 calories. That's not a lot. You can do a lot of, you know, with one tablespoonful of honey, you can sweeten quite a bit. And the other aspect about sweetness is, as a society, we like sweeter and sweeter and sweeter things. And once you get away from sweet things, you'll discover that you don't need as much sweetener for other things. You know, if you stay away from baked goods and you stick with fresh fruits, that.
I would agree with you on that. But with tea, I don't know why I just have to have it sweet. Tea.
I would use a teaspoon of honey in tea is great. Natural honey, you know, which is, honey is a natural product, but a teaspoon of honey would be fine. It's only 15 calories, so two teaspoons are 30 calories. That's not much. I would do honey. If you don't want any calories, stevia is where I would go.
Well, so thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks for listening, too. Appreciate it.
We do appreciate it. And before we head out, Zorba, time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Gail, who is speaking on behalf of the Florida Department of Citrus, wrote us a very thoughtful email regarding your remarks where you compared the caloric content of orange juice to that of soda. Here is an excerpt from her email. Dear Dr. Pastor, while we appreciate the viewpoint on calories, it is important to recognize the distinction between nutrient-dense beverages like 100% orange juice and grapefruit juice, and sugar-sweetened beverages like soda that contain few, if any, nutrients. An 8-ounce serving of 100% orange juice is an excellent source of vitamin C and is a good source of potassium, folate, and thiamine, which are carried over from the fruit to the juice. It also includes several other vitamins and minerals such as vitamin B6, magnesium, and vitamin A, as well as the flavonoid hesperidin, a polyphenolic compound found in oranges that may have beneficial effects on human health. Additional research suggests adults and children...
By the way, I love the way you pronounce those. You did an excellent
job. I just want to
let you know. Kudos for being able to pronounce those words. You're an honorary scientist.
I don't know what in the heck hesperidin and polyphenolic mean, but maybe you'll help me with that.
It's okay. It's okay. I'm the doctor. You know, you're the patient.
Additional research suggests adults and children who consume 100% orange juice tend to have better overall diet quality and nutrient adequacy as compared to those who don't consume orange juice. And as with all foods and beverages that provide calories, 100% fruit juices should be consumed in appropriate amounts that fit with an individual's overall diet and lifestyle.
That's great. It's wonderful. Now, I want you to repeat that all in one breath.
Dear Dr. Pastor.
Now, because she's from the Florida, what is it, Florida Citrus?
Yeah, Florida, Department of Florida Citrus.
Yeah, I don't think she's biased at all. I think this is...
Well, no, she's obviously making a case, but no, is her case okay?
Well, there is a case here. First of all, one of the issues that I think is important that we actually discussed is nutrient dense. So let's talk about calories.
Yeah.
And one of the issues I made was basically ounce for ounce, if you're getting 20 ounces of orange juice and you're getting 20 ounces of Coke, you're getting roughly the same number of calories. One is a little bit more than the other, and I can't remember which one. So there are a lot of kids who go, well, I can drink all the orange juice I want to, and they'll pick up 20-ounce bottles, and they'll drink it like Coke, and they're getting maybe 300 to 400, 500 calories of orange juice, and they think they're eating okay because it's not Coke.
Yeah.
It's not good. Now,
but
from
orange
juice
does have some good stuff in
100%. The reality is orange juice has other nutrients in it with Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola and Mountain Dew and all the others obviously don't because they're sweet non-nutrient beverages. Now, 6 ounces of orange juice, a juice glass full in the morning is excellent. And 6 ounces twice a day of orange juice, maybe 8 ounces, I think are fine sources. And I would continue to drink it. I drink orange juice and I like it. It's better to actually have oranges than orange juice because oranges have fiber in them. And they have pulp that are actually better for your digestion and better for you than juice. Juice is a quick way to get your fruit fix that you want to have, but it's really preferable to get the fiber with it. So I agree with her about the fact that it has all these other nutrients that are difficult to pronounce and micronutrients that are good. But I think it's also very important to think about the number of calories you're having and make sure that you're not drinking too much juice.
Good. Send us an email if you'd like, but make it a little shorter.
DeZorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or find us on Facebook.
And don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0426Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.